Welcome to episode 115 of Breakout Culture. I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and I'm the associate editor at Country and Townhouse magazine.
And I'm Ed Vasey, the culture editor at Country and Townhouse. And today we're going to be talking about a new play. It's about Samuel Beckett and Harold Pinter. And we're also going to be talking about a short film called Matar, which charts the day in the life of an asylum seeker in Britain. Our listeners will know that we're always interested in how culture is tackling difficult and contentious political issues. A while ago, we had the brilliant novelist Camilla Shamsie talking about her adaptation of a detainee's story for a series of contemporary refugee tales put together by the Gatwick Detainees Welfare Group. And of course, we had Anthony Biggs and Nick Kent talking about staging the play about Grenfell. Lenny Henry, of course, is currently starring in the Bush Theatre in August in England, his first foray into playwriting about a life impacted by the Windrush scandal. So there's clearly a growing appetite for looking at big issues through the lens of culture.
Yes, now Matar stars Ahmed Malik, who recently starred in the brilliant film about Syrian refugees, The Swimmers. The film is based on the experiences of a cinematographer, Ayman Al-Hussein, and tells the story of a day in the life of asylum seeker Matar as he tries to survive in a city without being able to work legally or have a bank account. The film's been directed by the award-winning director and asylum seeker, Hassan Akkad, and we're delighted he's here with us this morning. Good morning, Hassan.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Shomit Datta, who's written a play, Stumped. It's about Pinter and Beckett. It's premiering at Theatre Royal Bath, and then we'll move to Cambridge Arts Theatre and then to London's Hampstead Theatre. Stephen Tompkinson plays Beckett and Andrew Lansell plays Pinter. He's going to join us shortly, but we're delighted that Shomit's already with us.
While we wait for Andrew, let's start with you, Hassan. Now, I've seen the short film and it's pretty powerful and upsetting. So can you start by telling us a bit about your own journey from Syria to here?
I travelled from Syria to Britain in 2015, taking a similar route to the route that people are taking currently. It took me 3 months to get to England. And it was a journey that was both quite risky, but also exciting because you are, you know, traveling to your new home. After I got here, things were a lot easier back then than now, because today, with the new policies, with the Rwanda scheme, and with the rise of the anti-migrant rhetoric, it's becoming incredibly hostile, not just in England, but on every European border. After I got here, I claimed asylum. And then after 6 months of being an asylum seeker, I got my refugee status. I used to be an English teacher back home where I'm from in Damascus, Syria. But when I came here, I started working in filmmaking because I'm very passionate about stories. I used to tell stories for a living, so it wasn't a big of a difference to make films. What I've noticed since I've arrived to England is the change in the way that the UK is receiving migrants and refugees. Very recently, the Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, called it an invasion, which is a very dangerous thing to do, because when that happened around the time when a couple of, you know, right-wing men threw a petrol bomb on a migrant reception center in Dover. So I think my own experience and the experience of the people who worked with me and the change that we are witnessing, the very terrifying changes that we're witnessing in England in terms of when it comes to receiving migrants and refugees, all inspired us to make this small film. You mostly hear about asylum seekers and refugees through the lens of the news or the newspapers. And it's talked about in numbers, in facts, in statistics, but there's hardly enough stories. I think stories are incredibly powerful in getting people to relate to a certain topic. So the story of Matar is a story of a young man who we don't say where he's from intentionally, because I believe that there's a hierarchy in the refugee system where, you know, Ukrainians are placed on the top of that hierarchy. But other people from other countries are not. And he's a young man because young single men are the ones who are demonized the most in the press. So we find him in London as an asylum seeker. And because asylum seekers are not allowed to work, he's forced through no fault of his own to find an illegal job. And that's what he does. He does he takes a job doing deliveries, working in a food delivery world. unlike The Swimmers, I don't know if you've seen The Swimmers, but The Swimmers is a story about, you know, two incredible sisters who've done incredible things. But I wanted to, you know, I wanted to make a film about the everyday man, the you know, the people that are keeping our Londoners fed 24/7. So he takes that job and he starts building a community. And, you know, he's starts building, you know, himself as well, and paying for a mattress in a dust house. And then he gets hounded by the immigration and gets arrested. And we don't know whether he gets deported or not.
Well, just before we go on and find out what you're going on to try and achieve with this film and how it's being distributed, Andrew Lancel has now joined us. Good morning, Andrew.
Hey, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good, just done the school run.
Very good to hear. So, I mean, what is it about artistic partnerships that is so interesting? I know that after this play, you're going to go on and do another one about Oscar Wilde meeting Walt Whitman. So tell us what you think it is that there's so much, playwrights seem to find so much juicy material in imagining what it would have been like if so-and-so met so-and-so. In this case, obviously, Samuel Beckett and Harold Pinter.
Well, I think there's something that's exciting for a writer and hopefully for an actor about sort of turning the tables on a writer. So, you know, so many people will have perhaps played parts written by Beckett and Pinter. And then to have the opportunity to play Beckett and Pinter themselves, I think is something that's exciting. It's something I've been interested in partly because of academic study. I kind of studied a playwright called Aristophanes, who particularly enjoyed doing this as well, sort of 2,500 years ago. And, you know, he put in his favourite playwrights of his day, so that's Aeschylus and Euripides, into a kind of, in one play, into the underworld, sort of competing with each other. And I thought there'd be something very fun about putting Pinter and Beckett in a neutral scenario, like a cricket match, which is something that they both watched a lot of and played a lot of. I thought that would be enjoyable.
Well, yes, now, Andrew, I'm very interested in you taking on this role. People know you from Corrie and The Bill and things. You are not usually known from playing a very highbrow playwright. So what drew you to this departure?
A couple of years before, I directed a play about I directed a Pinter play, and so I sort of went back and looked at my Pinter library and realised I had all his plays. I'd been to see pretty much all his plays. I'd got two or three biographies, and realised, like with most actors, Harold's quite a big part of your life, whether it's subliminal or inadvertently, or whether you're a professional person working for him, with him, or saying his words. And so I was instantly fascinated by the scenario of being Harold or absorbing Harold with Samuel Beckett, another one of my heroes, in a cricket match, which I love. There was a lot of box ticked, but the thing that got me from the moment I read it and I couldn't get it out of my head was the friendship. Because you were talking about all those different art meetings, which there are always kind of trends. Right now, there's a lot of trends of films being made about Nike and Tetris and the beginnings of business, and you're right, there are a lot of plays been written about artistic partnerships, but this one was very real and very loving, sometimes paternal relationship. And Shobhna has captured not just the essence of the writings and the playing and the kind of the temperaments and the humor, but this deep friendship, which was real. I often think about, it's like, you know, it could be Oscar Wilde and Shakespeare on a park bench having a chat. But in this case, these guys knew each other and I think loved each other. And there's a lot of humour and a lot of silliness and a lot of mayhem and a lot of cricket. But at the core of it, I think there's these two titans of literature who happen to be friends.
But I think that's absolutely fascinating what you're saying about cricket. Could tell us about that, Shomit, because Beckett was the only writer to have been in Wisden. Can tell us about that and how much Pinter love cricket, and did they play cricket together?
Well, that's interesting. So they both loved cricket. Beckett played at school in quite a formal way. He went to this school, the Patora Royal School, which you know, was a bit like sort of Northern Ireland's Eton, and was very good at rugby. Apparently, was a brilliant boxer, which you wouldn't think to look at him necessarily. But he sort of played cricket in that way and played for Trinity Dublin and therefore ended up playing first-class cricket. Harold, very differently, played with a kind of, not even a proper cricket ball, in Hackney Marshes using a tree for the stumps. You know, it's a very, you know, it's a sort of... And so he didn't sort of play cricket formally and stopped playing, obviously, when he sort of started becoming an actor, and then took it up again when he took his son for some cricket coaching in his 30s. So they've got quite sort of different cricket careers. Beckett sort of never played, we think, past the age of 23 or something, 22. So he stopped very early. They never played together. They did discuss cricket a lot. I mean, I was in a fortunate position to be playing cricket. I still do, actually. We played yesterday for the team that Harold ran for many years, Gaieties CC.
What's the criteria for membership of Gaieties?
Well, usually it's sort of word of mouth or just meeting someone at a game. But I was...
Are they all involved in the arts, the Gaieties players?
Interestingly, they're not all involved in the arts. There are lots of theatre teams, but Gaieties, sort of only about half the people are tangentially connected to the arts. I mean, we did have people like Sam Mendes played for a number of years. Well before my time, I was told Tom Stoppard kept wicket. So there have been sort of big theatre people, but in many cases, it's just people who know those people. You know, it's sort of a bunch of mainly Londoners. The main characteristics of the team seem to be that no two people agree about anything. They're very difficult to, very difficult to captain.
Sounds like the play.
But it's a brilliant Trivial Pursuit question that who is the only Nobel Prize winner to be mentioned in Wisdom's.
Yeah.
It's a cracker.
Yeah, I mean, Harold actually, he won't thank me for saying this from on high, but he never scored a 50. So, I mean, he was an extremely enthusiastic player, but by his own admission... sort of limited and idiosyncratic in terms of how he went about it. And in fact, some of his best stories are about games he's managed to sort of mess up in some way. And I kind of did take that on board in writing the play.
So, Andrew, you and Stephen Tompkinson, do either of you actually play cricket in real life?
Yeah, Stephen's, I would to use a football analogy, Stephen's very much a Premier League, Champions League fan and a decent player. I'm not a bad player. I played, at sort of high village level in Lancashire. But I'm probably more of a Championship fan if he's a Premier League fan. But we've had a great experience, you know, dipping our toe into the cricket world. I did a eulogy at my aunt's funeral about 2 or 3 weeks ago. She was 91 and a mad diehard cricket fan, and so a lot of the analogies and kind of comparisons in that eulogy were cricket led and music of cricket and things. And my daughter, who's 5, has just started playing cricket at school, and so even now there's a 85 year range of cricket in my family. So but I mean cricket is the perfect metaphor for a play anyway, and then if you happen to start bringing in the worlds of Pinter and Beckett, it sits beautifully. I mean, it's a play about cricket in many ways, but it's also a play about these, as I say, these huge brains who like a drink and like to hit balls.
Cricketers can write as well, like Mike Atherton, and Mike Brearley was a philosopher.
Mike Brearley, Shamit knows, and was involved in a Q&A when we first did this at Lord's Cricket Ground. We filmed it last year at Lord's Cricket Ground. It was to be broadcast live. Unfortunately, the Queen died, so we weren't able to broadcast it live, but it was filmed. And then it went online, streamed, this new way of watching theatre, and got a bit of a life. And then it's been picked up, and we start down in beautiful, beautiful Bath, one of my favourite cities. And then, where do we go then?
Cambridge.
Cambridge, and then, yeah, and then London for a while.
And you end up really near Lord's. And sometimes I think it's such a pity we're on a podcast, because listeners, if you could see Andrew's face, he's obviously really loving being in this play. I mean, you look as if you're really enjoying it.
No, I'm enjoying speaking to you guys. I love Bath, I have to say, or Bath. Mm. I remember playing Bath Theatre Royal first time in 1996. And... going around the theatre about middle of the night looking for the ghosts. And I've played it many times since. And Stephen's also hugely excited about coming back to Bath. It's one of those venues that when you see you're touring or opening a play there or a pre-London play, you kind of go, oh, yeah. And this works perfectly there. I'm sure it's going to be go down all right there.
Well, congratulations for translating it digitally onto the stage. And, of course, it's coming back almost within feet of Lord's Cricket Ground at the Hampstead Theatre.
Yes, a lot of people, I know several, but I'm sure Shamit does too, people who are going down to see the test and our play Ashley, let's get the billing right. Coming down to see our play and then going to the test.
The Hampstead is where Harold's play The Dumb Waiter was first done. Not the same building, I mean, it's been rebuilt. But and in fact, Cambridge, I think, was where The Birthday Party got its first...
Was it? Didn't know that.
No. Live production. So, yeah, exciting that there is that connection. And obviously Lourdes, yeah, Hampstead's the nearest, as you say, Charlotte, nearest theatre to Lourdes. Which is fun for us. Yeah.
I'm always very loath to say, particularly when he's there, to say how clever the play is, because it can be quite distant, isn't it? Plays very clever. It is clever, but it's clever in a very good and warm way, and very funny, very funny. But don't tell him, it's really hard. It's really hard. Really hard work. Being Pinter is really hard. It's all right for Tomkinson. No one knows what Beckett looked like or sounded like, really.
Everyone knows what Beckett looked like. Because he was such a striking man.
But very, very, very few interviews or footage.
Yeah, there are no recordings of his voice. Almost.
Nothing at all, yeah.
I think Beckett was better looking than Pinter.
Andrew's looking quite upset now.
Oh, he was, yes, gorgeous. Yeah. He was certainly a character. And I mean, I'm even wearing some of Pinter's own cricket gear in this play, courtesy of Shomlett. So he's very close to us.
Ooh. So that's a huge success for your digital beginnings, now a play. So back to you now, Hassan. What do you plan to do with Matar? Because you have had some huge successes. I mean, you worked on The Swimmers, which is one of my favourite films, which I absolutely
loved. Oh, wonderful.
Wasn't it brilliant?
Wonderful, yeah. Wonderful. And a sort of secret. It's one of those films that you kind of enjoy telling people about. Have you not seen? And then they come back and go, yeah. Bravo.
Thanks for your sweet words. I think, personally, I always measure the success of a film by its impact. And, you know, like when people start telling one another about the films that they've liked, I think that's a great impact. In terms of Matar, we had around 5,000 people writing letters to their MPs about the new bill, which is going to technically ban asylum in Britain. So I think that is, you know, that's great impact. And also, another way of measuring impact for me is who is telling the story, who's making the film, because 50% of the people, over 50% of the people who worked on the latest film are from a migrant background. And I all for, you know, us telling our own stories for so many reasons, because I think, you know, it's the nuances, you know, I think it's also the context is very important, because when you watch Matar, it's not just about the agony, it's not just about the hardships, it's also about the fun. He's a flawed character. He steals a bike in the film. He just wants to go to this house party. So it's like about humanizing our characters as well.
Hassan, can I ask you some questions about asylum seekers in general? Because I think our listeners will be quite interested. You talk about the demonization in the press, and these are very interesting and complicated issues. I mean, for example, your average Daily Mail reader will say, why wouldn't people who are fleeing Syria stop in the first country they come to in Europe? Why do people go to Calais and then want to come to the UK? Why was the UK your destination?
I mean, that's a very valid question to ask. And my answer is that I think that security and safety is not just about fleeing a war zone and not having bombs fall on top of your house. It's also about community and friendship and family. And often the case of people, in my case, I came to London in England is because I could speak English already, and it will be a lot easier for me to start over and to integrate. And I had so many friends here who could help me start over. So,
and a lot of people also say that the government doesn't allow any kind of legal routes to seek asylum. I mean, were you able to seek asylum once you left Syria? Were you able to?
There are no
to...
legal routes. And that's unfortunately, I mean, there's always a... before the Rwanda scheme, I don't know if you've heard, but the Priti Patel was considering putting wave machines in the channel. They've always thought about how can we stop people from coming. I am all for stopping irregular routes, because I think crossing the channel in a flimsy dinghy is risky. People died doing that. But what's the alternative? Because take Sudan, for example. Sudan is right now going through crises. You can't walk into an embassy in Sudan or in Egypt and say, I want to claim asylum in England. There's no such thing. The resettlement has stopped. There are no regular and safe routes for people to come here. So that's why they are pushed to go and work, you know, and pay all their money to people smugglers so they can offer them the route.
And do you think in theory there's kind of no limit to the amount of people who could come to the UK claiming asylum?
I think there's definitely a limit, because I mean... I've been on both ends. I was an asylum seeker, and now I'm a British citizen. And it's, you know, one has to be sensible. You know, we obviously Britain can't take everyone, because we, as a country, sadly, because of poor governance, we do have limited resources. And, you know, you can't just say, okay, bring 1 million people here. But I think Britain has to take its fair share of people. You know, we are, I think, third or fourth on the list of exporting weapons and bombs. And weapons and bombs are usually destabilizing countries and regions. So if we want to, you know, make tons of money selling weapons and bombs to other countries, we've got to step up and take more people who are fleeing war zones.
I'm not sure if a lot of people know this about you, Hassan, but you famously projected your film Led by Donkeys onto the white cliffs of Dover. I don't know, Shomit and Andrew, if you ever saw that film, but it was that was quite dramatic. It was your enormous projection of your face on the cliffs of Dover.
I do already have a ginormous head, and then when it was projected on the cliffs, it looked even bigger. You know, it was a 90-second film. When I said, you know, a very small story about stats, I gave some stats and some figures. I talked about the people who have witnessed working on the front line during the coronavirus pandemic. And I said, you know, just give a passionate message about why I think this country should take some more people. And I think that was a very successful campaign because, again, you know, I think our voices are often lost in this conversation. So you hear politicians, pundits, you know, people from, you know, the left and the right talking about it. But where are the refugees themselves? Where are the asylum seekers? Where are the people with lived experience? But Matar, I'm already developing the feature length of it. I mean,
are you?
I was hoping to send it to festivals and then, you know, some it will get on people's radars. But I had a very major broadcaster get in touch and said that they would like to work with me on the feature length of it. So I've been doing that for the last 5-6 weeks, trying to write something up. So that's the next step. It's hopefully getting that development deal signed and start writing the scripts. And because the story has got so many layers to it. In my research, actually, I've discovered just yesterday that there isn't a rough estimate on how many undocumented people live in Britain, but the closest estimate is 1 million people. 1 million people live in Britain under the radar. They have no document. The only legal thing they can do is buying a bus pass. That's the only thing. The rest is, there's this paddle of Britain that exists where people, you know, you can technically still do everything. Except opening a bank account or going on holiday. But it's a very interesting world that people have created, and it's growing and growing because of the hostile environment. And a very interesting fact I learned yesterday as well is that the tax contribution of the undocumented community is around £5 billion a year, which is enough to fund the Home Office. It's all a bit mad. So the feature length of Matar will take place in that world.
Great. Well, good luck with that. That needs to be made.
Well, I'm sure you'll succeed because, you know, The Swimmers was a huge success. And also you have won a BAFTA already for your documentary. Yeah. which can you still see it on the BBC? It's called Exodus, Our Journey to Europe.
Yes. Yes, still available on BBC iPlayer. And we made it, 2016? Seven years ago now. Oh, my God.
But where can we see Matar in the meantime while we wait for it to become a feature film?
Matar is available to watch for free on waterbear.com. You just have to sign up for free. They're not going to spam you. It's a user-friendly platform. And, it's a 20-minute film. Do watch it.
Well, I highly recommend it. So I've seen it and I really enjoyed it. So well done and good luck with it. And huge good luck with the cricket play as well. It's called Stumped, which the clue really is in the title. But we really look forward to that. Thank you all so much for coming on and telling us all about two very, very different endeavours.
Yep, my pleasure.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having us.
That's it for another episode of Breakout Culture, but please don't forget to visit countryandtownhouse.com, where you'll find the latest edition of the magazine and our sister podcast, House Guest with Carol Annette, in which she talks to some of the most fascinating and influential names in interior design. If you enjoyed today, please make sure you follow us or subscribe. And if you listen on Apple Podcasts, we'd love you to leave us a rating and a review, as it really helps others to find the show. And don't forget to follow Country and Townhouse on social media. You can find the links to all our accounts in the podcast show notes. We'll be back on air with a new podcast at the same time next Friday.
Talking of House Guest, Carol Annette is talking to graphic artist and homeware designer Emma Shipley this week about her latest enchanting and colourful collection featuring the Guatemalan Quetzal bird. So do tune into that. Now, next week, we're going to be talking about design, because the London Design Biennale opens on the 1st of June at Somerset House with over 40 exhibitors from around the world, as usual, providing thought-provoking installations and design solutions to some of the world's most pressing challenges. Victoria Brokes, the director of the Biennale, is going to be with us to give our listeners a heads up. So make sure you tune in then. And meanwhile, have a lovely weekend. Goodbye.